Hello and welcome to the Relationship Super Conference. My name's Jaya Bristow and I'll be one of your hosts. And today I'm very excited to be joined by Kevin Patterson. Welcome, Kevin.
Hey, thank you so much for having me aboard.
Thank you for joining us. I'm really excited about the conversation we're going to be having around race in polyamory. So Kevin Patterson has been practicing ethical non-monogamy since August of 2002 after opening up a relationship which eventually became his marriage. In April of 2015, Kevin was inspired to start Poly Role Models, an interview series for people describing their experiences with polyamory. To continue that discussion of polyamorous representation, Kevin has extended the blog's work into the writing of the book Love's Not Colorblind: Race and Representation in Polyamorous and Other Alternative Communities. Along with co-writer Alana Phelan, Kevin launched a sci-fi novel series, For Hire. Beginning in 2020, Kevin has worked with Dr. Liz Powell to create the Unfuck Your Polyamory educational series, including lessons for both individual users as well as service providers. Unfuck is designed to help people navigate the world of consensual non-monogamy whilst avoiding a lot of the common mistakes. That's a great bio, Kevin. So for our listeners who are unfamiliar with polyamory, do you want to start by talking a little bit about that, what it is and what drew you to it?
I know that there's some moving around as far as the definition, but like the most general idea is polyamory is the ability or the desire or the behavior of dating more than one person with having more than one romantic and or sexual relationship with the check-in, with the consent, with the full knowledge and understanding of everybody involved. For me, I sort of fell backwards into polyamory. It wasn't like an intentional choice. My wife and I, my then girlfriend, now wife, we just sort of fell into an open situation. And once we got there, we realized it was the best fit for us in terms of freedom and ability to move around. We were able to have like our loving relationship and our situation, and then able to navigate other relationships in ways that didn't interfere with what she and I had together.
Fantastic. And so You've been practicing polyamory for almost 20 years now. Okay. And so could you tell me a little bit about your experiences of navigating the world of polyamory as a Black man?
Well, my wife and I, like at first, when we first started dating outside of our own relationship, there was sort of a scarcity mindset where I was dating, whoever would have me, as far as like, if I liked somebody and they were willing to date someone who was already in a relationship, cool. But then eventually I sort of found my way to the polyamory community. Whereas like I started reading books, I started like joining online message boards, I started like learning more about what we had already been doing. And once I found the polyamory community, like I live in the Philadelphia area, and the Philadelphia area is anywhere between like 40 and 45% Black. And that just wasn't reflected in the polyamory community as I found it. So like I'd start going to events and I'd find myself being like either the only Black guy, the only person of color, one of very few people of color at an event, And it became such a common thing that I started talking about it. It wasn't my intent to like lead anything, write any books, do any, speaking engagements or anything like that. I was just talking about my experiences, how few times I would go to an event and meet other Black people there. And next thing you know, like somebody said like, hey, Kev, maybe you should be talking about this in educational spaces. Maybe you should be writing about this as well. And enough people responded to that I realized that it wasn't just a problem in the Philadelphia area. It wasn't just my problem. It was a problem that I'd run into all over the place. And when you speak to polyamorous folks, specifically in communities, you run into people who feel enlightened. You run into people who feel quote unquote woke. You run into people who have a lot to say about gender politics, who have a lot to say about identity politics, who have a lot to say about sexuality. But when you bring up race, those same people get real quiet. Those same people get, you know, they get suspiciously quiet. And, you know, when you look at who's in these communities, who the organizers are, who, you know, who these folks are dating, you know, you've got the ability to date anybody you're interested in within the, you know, within the boundaries of your specific polyamorous structure, but you've got the ability to date multiple people, and you find that, like, that's not extending to people of color. That's not extending to Black people. And you have to start asking the questions why. You have to start wondering. And that became sort of the catalyst for me to start doing educational work in these spaces.
Amazing. There's a lot of what you're saying is very relatable. So I was part of the polyamorous community in London for quite a few years. And again, I always say, if I'm the darkest person in the room, there's a problem. And I wasn't always, there was a few other people of color there and a few Black people, but there it was a very much a minority. So why do you think that is?
There's a lot of different reasons. A lot of it ends up being not intentional planning by organizers, where I'd see an event and the event would be like some part of town where there aren't any Black people. There'd be, you know, an event where, like, Black folks in America and Black folks pretty much all over the place are marginalized by way of class. So if you've got something, whether it's polyamory or any other hobby that has a financial barrier, that's going to be an increased financial barrier for people who are marginalized by way of class. So, like, there are times where I've gone to events and realized that, like, if I didn't make as much money as I did in my everyday job, I wouldn't be able to attend this thing. If I couldn't afford babysitting, I couldn't attend this thing, you know? If I didn't have a car, I wouldn't be able to go to this thing. You know, there's so many times where that comes up, where these events aren't accessible for any number of reasons. And then when you get there, some of the ways that people treat Black folks, they might think of as welcoming, but we don't, you know? There have been times where I've gone to events and been fetishized, and, like, that makes me feel dehumanized. That makes me feel like the only thing I have to offer to a space is Blackness. And if that's what you want me here for, that's not what I want myself here for, you know? I'm here to meet people. I'm here to date. I'm here to discuss. I'm here to find fellowship, to socialize. And if somebody's like, oh, well, we see you and you're Black and you must have that big Black dick, now I'm interested, that's not really what I'm here for. And it's othering, it's dehumanizing. And while someone else might think that that's welcoming, it really pushes folks out of spaces. The first time I went to an event in my local community, I remember that it was a big deal, because the local community hadn't held like a get together in a long time. And so, like, there were dozens of folks, but only like 7 Black folks. And some of those Black folks came in my car, you know? So if I'm bringing like almost half of the Black population of this party with me, if I wasn't going, that would be, you know, even less. And like some of the people who didn't arrive with me were folks who never went back to events, like who felt marginalized, who felt othered in those spaces, and then didn't come back to community events until I became a community organizer and started hosting them myself, you know?
Go ahead.
Oh, well, what I was going to say, and I apologize for cutting you off. Polyamory and polyamory communities are so niche that a lot of us just want to have a population. A lot of us just want to be able to get 20, 30, 40 people to a happy hour, you know, to a potluck, to a movie night. And they're not worried about the demographics, because they just want to get any number of people. So when that ends up being the case, if you're not like actively trying to work towards inclusivity, that's going to fall by the wayside. And the people who aren't there are going to stop being there. Like, I know folks who have told me, like, hey, Kev, I never went to that event until they started advertising the next year and your picture was in the event. You know, your picture was on the website. Then I decided to go. Like, that shouldn't be the only reason. That shouldn't be the focal point. It should feel safe and comfortable for everybody who wants to arrive, but that's just not always the case.
Absolutely. And I think that's what I was going to say around inclusivity. What you're speaking to is really important, both in the polyamorous communities, but also just in general. Often people say, oh, our events are open to everyone. We're inclusive. But it's like, how are you actively being inclusive? What are you doing to really make people feel included and invited into your spaces? And it's particularly important in spaces where people are already marginalized, were already in minority groups like polyamorous spaces or queer spaces. It's even more, it's like, you know what it feels like to be marginalized. So it's so important to really make sure you take into account race and gender and sexuality, sexual orientations in those kind of spaces, as well as class, like you mentioned.
Yeah. And it's not even just those things, like just in terms of like, in terms of organizing, in terms of being a community leader, in terms of wanting to like set up events, you've got to be really intentional with that stuff. Because there have been times where I've been invited to a thing and I go there and I look at the way the parking is, or I look at the way the stairs are, or I look at, you know, the kind of stuff that's allowed at the venue. And I'm like, boy, if I had an assistive device, if I had a cane or crutches or a wheelchair, I'd never be able to go to this thing. You know, and or if I was sober, if I was, you know, if I, you know, if I needed any amount of accommodations, so much of the community would be inaccessible to me. And so often when it comes to race, it's the people themselves, you know, the kind of things that get allowed. Where I remember being at an event a few years ago where I was trying to talk about abusers. In local communities, and somebody wanted to have a conversation with me about that. Cool. And then halfway into the conversation, he's like, yeah, you know, we don't really have racial problems in our community. You know, my wife loves Black people. She's got a Queen of Spades tattoo. And I'm like, whoa. Because like, if you were unaware, spade is a racial slur against Black people. So the idea that this Queen of Spades tattoo, which is hardcore fetishizing of Black bodies, like that was supposed to draw me in as like, oh, okay, well, these are my people. These are people I should feel comfortable with, because she's got this racial slur tattoo that's fetishizing racial slur tattoo on her leg. Like I was kind of stunned by the presumption there. And I completely redirected the conversation about abuse and abusers. I was like, hey man, this isn't the conversation you came here for, but here's the conversation you're about to get. You're about to get a whole, like, I don't think he was too pleased with that, but it's not my job to make people feel comfortable with racism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there's a couple of things you mentioned there that are really, really key. I think one of them was intentional inclusivity and intentional accessibility. And yes, another is how, you know, using, oh, I date Black people as a proof that you're not racist, like that is the complete opposite. Fetishization is a form of racism.
Yeah. So, and misogynists date women all the time, and murderers date living people. So I don't know why we're having the conversation of I date Black people. That's, yeah.
Exactly. So how do you navigate the racial dynamics in the polyamorous community and in your dating life?
I mean, I've got, in my personal dating life, I've got to do a lot more vetting of the people that I'm with, where like some of my partners are white, and we can't avoid the conversation about the racial dynamics present there. You know, they're like, if I'm dating someone and they're like, hey, Kev, you know, come over to my place. Here's a key. You know, there's a key under the welcome mat at my place. You know, come on over. We have to have a conversation, because if I show up to some house in some unfamiliar neighborhood and go digging around for a hidden key to walk into a house where the neighbors don't know me, that could mean a police encounter that might threaten my safety or my life, you know? So we have to have a whole conversation about that. Like, I have to understand where people are coming from in terms of their racial dynamics. And like, I'm a cisgender guy. I understand that my partners who are primarily assigned female at birth, we've got to have conversations about the gender dynamics as well, you know, because I know I know that there are certain things I can't talk to my partners about in terms of like their own safety, their own health and well-being. So I've got to vet my partners really hard in terms of navigating community space. Like, it can be a balancing act where if I notice that how the demographics look on a regular basis and I have to talk to organizers about it, a lot of times I have to talk to organizers in a really soft way, because if I'm like, hey, there's a problem with the race problem here, if there's a problem with the demographics in this space, they're not going to see that. They're not going to see the demographics as a problem. They're going to see me as the problem. A lot of times, like I've had situations where people, you know, have wanted to block me from coming to places, not because I was a problem in the space, but because I pointed out the problems in the space.
Right. Yeah.
You know, which is why I'm always appreciative of my white friends for pointing out those things for me, because okay, so there was, I don't know if it still exists, but there was a Facebook group called White Nonsense Roundup. And whenever I was like having if you're like arguing race with somebody online, you could tag this Facebook group and a white representative from this group would come in and handle the argument for you. And every single time that I've tagged this group, these folks would show up with lightning speed and make all the same points that I was making. And at the end, the person I was arguing with would be like, oh, wow, thank you for explaining it to me. Mm-hmm. The same person who had been belligerent and angry and, you know, and aggressive with me would be thankful to this other white person who stepped in on my behalf. I'm always appreciative of like the white folks who have these conversations with me or who have these conversations for me, because they're not going to be seen as, you know, as the angry, aggressive black guy. They're going to be seen as a friend, as a concerned friend, whether I was angry or aggressive or not. And realistically, angry and aggressive isn't really my style. Not throwing shade to anybody that rolls that way, but I'm a pretty chill guy. My temperature doesn't go too high for anything.
And it's interesting because even though you say you're not angry and aggressive, just the fact of being a black man means that certain people will read you that way when you're disagreeing or pointing something out. And
all the time.
Exactly. And what you're saying, you know, when people say, why does everything have to be about race? Why are we bringing race into it? It's like, well, when you're a person of color, everything is about race. From the example you were giving about, you know, checking for the spare key under the mat, that for you isn't the same experience as it would be for a white guy. And yeah. Again, the importance of white allyship is really crucial. And that's such a great example. And that's so great to hear about that Facebook group. I'm not on Facebook anymore, but it's good to know that there are people out there doing that kind of work. How then do you feel one can be more mindful of partners of all different, I guess, colors, but how can we be more mindful of our partners in terms of race?
I mean, a lot of it just comes down to listening and not being defensive. A lot of it comes down to just that, like in our individual relationships, where like there have been times where somebody's called me out on something problematic that I said. My first instinct is to be like, no, I didn't do anything wrong. Everything's okay. I don't know what your problem is. But then it's like, you know what? It took a lot for this person to say this to me. It took a lot of courage for this person to tell me that they had a problem with something that I did or something that I said. I should listen to them and understand where they're coming from. Even if at the end of the day, we don't agree and we can have a conversation about why, just listening to them and understanding where they're coming from. There are so many times where I see people get like, you know, so I see somebody say something, you know, problematic in any number of ways. And then when you're like, hey, friend, that thing that you said is not going to go over too well in the way that you think it is. And then it gets heated when it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to get aggressive. It doesn't have to get to that place, you know? Just listening to people and understanding where they're coming from, understanding how much effort it takes, you know? Like just the fact that somebody, like, I'm not going to sit there and try to explain my humanity to somebody who's a complete scumbag. You know, if I'm talking to you and saying like, hey, this is a problem, it's because I believe you can fix the problem. It's because I believe in you enough that you can solve whatever this problem is and that we can come to some kind of an accord. So just being able to like stop and listen to people, like there are so many times where, you know, I've, like I said, most of my partners are women or assigned female at birth. And their socialization is different from mine. Their struggle is different from mine in a way that I won't even understand because it's so different. And when they say like, hey, Kev, we got to talk about something. Hey, Kev, this is a way, you know, this is the way something looked to me. I've got to hear them or I mark myself as an unsafe person for them to be around.
Absolutely. And I think that's really important in all types of relationships is like, and I think the world would be such a better place if everyone took a bit more time to listen to each other rather than trying to get their point across. And especially when people have belong to groups that are different to ours and have social identities that are different to ours and have experiences therefore that are different to ours, we can learn so much by listening, whether that's white people listening to people of color's experience or men listening to women's experiences or cisgendered people listening to trans people's experiences. So I really appreciate that advice. Thank you.
Well, yeah. And that's just my own personal experiences. I see people get into a lot of trouble struggling to be right when really they should be, you know, struggling to understand.
Yeah. And so we've touched upon this a little bit already, but what is wrong, in your opinion, about having a racial preference, whatever that preference is and whether it's monogamous or non-monogamous relationships? What's wrong with having a racial preference?
Racial preferences don't come from nowhere. They're not, you know, they don't just pop up out of nowhere. And there's like a lot of scientific research about this. There's a lot like goodness, I wish I remembered off the top of my head. A lot of like familiarity principle where when we meet people, like, there's a lot of study about the way we form attraction, and a lot of that is based on snap judgment, based on assumed social standing. You know, you see somebody, you make a, you know, and you get this reaction, and that reaction is based on socialization. And if you're in a white supremacist society, that's where that socialization is coming from. You know, whether that's me being black and like I have a fear of like of white supremacy. You know, if I'm making an assumption of white supremacy, that's where that's going. If you're making an assumption of, you know, of criminality or, you know, low intellect or whatever it is, that's not coming from nowhere, but that appears in our snap judgments when we form attraction. So the whole, I only date white people, that's not just about dating. It's not just going to come up it's going to come up in your social circle. It's going to come up at your job. It's going to come up with the way you treat someone at the bank, you know? We're recording this in July where the Euros just happened, and I'm seeing like all sorts of racism directed towards black soccer players who just lost this game. Black football players who just lost this game against Italy. And I'm sure that a lot of the people who are saying these racist things would not call themselves racist, you know, but these are the same, like, but this is the same way it pops up with the, I'm not dating black people. There's a reason why you don't see black people as people and you see them as a collection of tropes or a collection of characteristics or stereotypes or whatever it is. And that's not just limited to dating. That's going to impact the way, you know, that's going to impact how you help out a friend. That's going to impact, or somebody who you call a friend. That's going to impact the way you treat someone at work, a service worker, somebody who brings you your meal at a restaurant. That's going to impact all of those things. So the whole racial preference thing, it's a lot more than just, this isn't my type, you know? It's not blondes versus brunettes. It's a whole other thing, and we need to examine that. And we need to examine that, like, in ourselves, where that comes from. Because because it's not going to limit itself to the way you date.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing you say in that is that, like, what people might refer to as a dating preference is actually much more reflective of the way they see race in general and the way they treat people based on race in general, and is not at all limited solely to dating.
Exactly. And the whole, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, and like the whole idea of like, I wouldn't suggest to people just like, hey, well, you know, now that you've heard this information, go date some Black people to prove it to yourself. What I'm saying is you should be introspective about why you have these so-called dating preferences, because unless racism is where you're going and what you're comfortable with, you want to understand where these racist preferences are coming from so that you can be better in other aspects of your life. There's a thing called like mere familiarity principle, where, or mere exposure principle, where you're being around people who are not like you changes the way you see those people, changes the way you it makes people stop being a collection of stereotypes and makes them into like full-fledged people. Like, what I would say is, instead of just saying, well, I don't date Black people, and I want to, if your intent is to break down why that is, I would say change up the kind of media you bring in, because that's more of a safe environment. Change up the kind of shows that you watch. Change up the kind of books that you read. Where, like, there, like, I know folks who consider themselves well-read, and then like their bookshelves don't have any Black authors, you know? Like, I know people who love sci-fi and haven't read any N.K. Jemisin. It's like, well, N.K. Jemisin is winning a lot of awards right now. Maybe you should be taking in her work. I know a lot of people who won't seek out any media outside of like what's considered the norm, what's considered the classics, when really you could be changing the way you see the world, changing the way you see people around you. A video game series that I love. I love the Mass Effect video game series. It's my heart and my soul. I have a tattoo. I've got lots of paraphernalia. That's my series, and it's science fiction, lots of aliens, and I see people on message boards all the time talking about, wow, I'd love to be able to meet the aliens in such and such game. And I'm like, yeah, but like, you don't even meet people from the other side of your town where you live, you know? Right. You're not even comfortable with the quote unquote aliens who move from one country to your country. So why are we talking about science fiction aliens? Like, as if you'd be a different person to these fictional aliens than you are to like the real life people who live around the way from you.
Right.
You know? Oh, go ahead. You were taking in a breath. I heard you say something.
No, I was just going to say, no, it's really interesting what you're saying around, it's not so much about who you date as questioning why you're dating only a specific group of people, or why you're only sort of connecting with certain people, especially if those people look like you. And so then, which we've already talked a little bit about, but then I guess let's talk a bit more about the flip side of that. Because on one hand side, we have people who have a racial preference and say like, I don't date Black people, I'm white, I only date white people. It's a preference, I'm not racist. And then on the other side, you have people who are like, oh, I really love Black people, I only date Black people or Asian people or Hispanic people or whichever group of people it is. And then we're going into the fetishization. So yeah, let's talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people. There's a lot of people in the world to date, befriend, you know, engage with. And if you're limiting yourself to only a single race, like outside of your race, there's something else happening there, you know? Like, I've met people before where they're like, I only date Black people. And I'm a Black person that will not date those folks, because there's something else happening there, you know? If you can be of yourself a race and not see the value in dating other people of your own race, there's something happening there that it is not my problem to solve and is not my problem to enable. So there's a lot of introspection that doesn't go into dating. And when you look at the way things are modeled, from parents to pop culture, socialization, Disney movies, we don't get a lot of explanation on where we find attraction. We don't get a lot of explanation on what kind of value we bring to our partners, or, you know, although we do get a lot of information on what value we expect our partners to bring to us. But if I'm meeting somebody and they're not Black, but they only date Black people, I don't think they're as interested in me as they are in my race. One way or the other, that's fetishization that I can't deal with. And so I steer well clear of.
Absolutely. I recently told a white partner of mine, you know, who said that they don't see color. I'm like, I need you to see color. I need you to understand that my experiences are different to yours. And at the same time, I don't want you to see me just for my color. It's like, it's seeing the whole picture. It's especially when you're dating and you're having an intimate relationship with someone, it's so important to see the person, you know, the full picture of the person, their social identity, what they're going through, their gender, their race, and as well, or their ethnicity, as I prefer to say, but and everything beyond that, their personality, who they are, their humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. As I remember Chris Rock said it, you gotta see the crust of a person. You can't just see like the cheese and the sauce. You gotta see like what makes it underneath.
Absolutely. And whilst, you know, we started this conversation talking about polyamory and race and polyamory and your experiences of race and polyamory, a lot of what we're talking about here, racial dynamics, racial preferences, racial fetishization, I think can be applied in all types of relationships.
Yeah, 100%. I know so many mixed people who talk about the dynamics of being like an interracial child, like a child of interracial parents. And if we're not picking up on that kind of thing, if we're not picking up on these sort of dynamics, it doesn't just impact you. It impacts your kids in the way they grow up as well. I say that about like polyamory in general. Like a lot of what goes into the autonomy, the scheduling, the communication, a lot of things that polyamory thrives on, monogamous relationships would thrive on as well. Like in my little bit of experience with monogamous relationships, some 20 something years ago, there were so many times where my autonomy got restricted just because like I wanted to hang out with somebody who was a woman. She's a friend. I met her in a class. You know, I met her in a class. I met her in an event. We wanted to hang out and go see a movie. Can't do that. I got a girlfriend. Like that, you know, that doesn't need to be that way. But like in a mononormative society, like that's seen as a violation, or that can easily become a violation one way or the other. I see all the time, men who are like, well, I can't hang out with the boys because I've got a girlfriend. I've got to cut these people out of my life. Like, you really shouldn't have to do that. You know, you shouldn't have to do any of that kind of thing. There should be, if autonomy and respect of boundaries and that kind of thing will break up your relationship, you got to really examine the relationship. It's not, you shouldn't have to put in a bunch of loopholes to keep somebody in your life.
Absolutely. I think that's really crucial. And I know that for myself, you know, being part of the polyamorous community, I learned a lot about relationships and relating in general, that can be applied to, you know, all kinds of romantic relationship formats, monogamous, non-monogamous, but also friendships and just the way I treat the people in my life and all of that. So I really appreciate you bringing that in. And I was just going to mention as well, when you were talking about interracial relationships and being mixed race, that we have Zain Arati, who I think you've come across, I'm interviewing her specifically on interracial relationships as well for this conference.
Yeah, Zain is dope. So I'll be tuning in for that.
Fantastic. Well, I think we're coming to an end. So how can people find out more about you and your work?
Well, I'm Poly Role Models on everything. I'm Poly Role Models on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and Tumblr and Patreon and YouTube. But like my website is kevinapatterson.com, and that's where you can find out about the books that I work on. Love's Not Colorblind is in its third year, and Alana Phelan and I, we've been writing a series of queer polyamorous superhero novels, prose novels, just, you know, because everyone thinks they're comic books because they're about superheroes, but they are prose. We just released the third one in the series. The series is called For Hire. The first book was Operator. The second book was Audition. And now the third book, For Hire, Supercell, just released recently. Supercell is kind of a prequel to the first book, Operator, but we're really proud of all three. And like, we're really excited to have those out.
Fantastic. I know a lot of friends of mine who would love those kind of books. Awesome. And not just because of the representation, though, that too, but also because they're massive sci-fi fans and into superhero and novels and films and all of that kind of thing. And so yeah. It's great. And what we were talking a bit about before the interview about how representation is so important. And at the same time, it doesn't, you know, it's a bit like what we're talking about with inclusive spaces. It doesn't have to be everything. It doesn't have to be the main plot of the story. You can have a story about something else and include representation of marginalized groups.
Yeah, because like that's something I always wondered about, like science fiction, like even growing up, where like watching Star Trek or whatever it is, we've got like this wild world, this wide universe full of aliens and everything like that. And it still stars a cisgender straight white man, especially Star Trek, that sort of theorized a universe without racism, without homophobia or transphobia or anything like that. But then the story still follows a cisgender straight white man. So like we wanted to make sure that like while we put lots of representation in, that wasn't the focus of the story. Like we wanted to tell some good superhero stories, we wanted to tell some interesting narratives with some cool relationship dynamics, but like they're not coming out stories, they're not stories about, you know, about oppression. Like the main character in the second book, For Hire, Audition, is a Black trans woman, and her transition, it's mentioned because that's her story. It's not what the story is about. It's about, you know, a woman trying to get back on her feet after having some hiccups in her life. Mm-hmm. And also superhero stuff. So we wanted to make sure that we did it in a way where we were respective of identities without dealing exclusively with oppression and pain and so on. And then also we made sure to pay trans women consultants to look through our book to make sure we were getting the characterization right as well.
That's so great to hear. And I'm really excited to know that these books are coming out and that they're basically sounds like they're superhero novels that people can relate to and identify with the characters when they're not straight cis white men, which is fantastic because there's not many opportunities for that to happen otherwise.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I've got going is Dr. Liz Powell and myself, we have a series called Unfuck Your Polyamory. And it's a six class webinar. We recorded it live last year, and like we released it as recordings this year, where if you go to unfuckyourpolyamory.com, you can actually pay. And it's sort of pay what you will, for all six classes. And we're still working on a version of it for service providers. So like the one we have now is for people who want to explore polyamory, people who want to explore, people who want to bone up on their exploration of polyamory, people who just need information. Six classes on power dynamics and metamorph relationships and setting boundaries and like where to find partners and that sort of thing, like really practical information. And then we're working on a second one for service providers, where if you are someone like a therapist or a life coach or somebody who has a polyamorous clientele and you want to get better at, you want to get more, if you want to be trying to figure out the way to put this. If you want to be better schooled on polyamory as a way to benefit your polyamorous clients, we're working on a class specifically for that.
That's brilliant, because I know a lot of my non-monogamous friends really struggle with finding suitable therapists who don't just blame all their issues on their non-monogamous relationships. Yep. So I'm really glad to know that exists. So for listeners, viewers, check out unfuckyourpolyamory.com if you want to know more about polyamory, if you want to check out the classes, they're all accessible and it's pay what you can. Check out KevinAPatterson.com for more about Kevin's work, his book, Love is Not Colorblind, which is appropriate whether you're polyamorous or monogamous, but I'm sure you can learn a lot. And check out his social media at Poly Role Models. Models, plural, on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and all of that. Thank you so much, Kevin. It's been fantastic talking with you. I've learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners have too. And I hope to see you again soon.
Hey, thank you. I really appreciate the conversation.